From Paul's house and Storm's house, it's Paul and Storm talk about some stuff for 5 to 10 minutes, on average.
And now we're back where we started.
You don't even know what you're talking about. I'm Paul.
I'm Storm.
And we're going to talk about some stuff for 5 to 10 minutes.
Tonight, it's Wednesday, September
22nd. On average.
Oh, sorry. On average. Tonight, it's Wednesday, September 22nd, 2010.
And this is show 097.
Dash A. We'll explain that in a minute.
Well, actually, no, this will just be 097.
Okay.
Except no substitutes.
Oh, who is that speaking? We don't know yet because we haven't introduced him, except we sort of have. Go ahead, Storm.
It's foreshadowing. We currently have 363 minions in the Paul and Storm Brigade of Minions. Go to paulandstorm.com to find out how to join and be a big block dandy. As alluded to just a minute ago, we're going to break the suspense right away with us, for real, for sure, is... character actor, actor, raconteur, personality, James Urbaniak.
Hello, James.
Hello. Hello, Podmerica.
Now, we have some splaining to do. If we seem a bit laughy and if that introduction was a little bit rushed, it's because we have actually previously already done a podcast with James Urbaniak
scant minutes ago.
Pretty However, much full length. It was close to an hour.
It was about 50 minutes worth of recording.
And it was not actually recorded. So, in fact...
There were some technical difficulties on one of our ends.
Well, let me explain. Now, I play Dr. Venture, but I'm really kind of a science neophyte, and I'm not that technically proficient at things. And, you know, I've done these podcasts interviews in the past.
I actually heard you'd use the finger quotes as you said that.
I was actually sort of looking down shamefully. But I've done them with our friend Ken Plume, and I've done some other ones, and I've always just done this thing where I wear my little Logitech headset, and the other person records me. And then when you hear it, it sounds like I'm on the phone. Which
right.
I am on the phone. So why is that an issue? So today, Paul messages me and says, hey, do you want to do a podcast? In fact, we're doing one tonight if you're available. And I said, yeah, that sounds like fun. And then you sent me some, we had this back and forth where you're like, well, can you record it? And I said, oh, I've never actually done that before. You know, the other people have recorded. And Paul, I guess to his credit, said, oh, well, it's a cleaner sound if you can record it, you know. And I had just recorded this little joke fake podcast with my son, you know, it was like a 3-minute gag on this little medium range microphone that I have that you're hearing my voice on now, hopefully. And and so I looked into it and just had to literally figure out, oh, can I put two different jacks in my Mac at the same time? Will both things work? And, oh, yes, actually, yes, I can listen to you guys via Skype on my headset and talk to you via my little headset mic thing.
All these technical terms, James.
Recording myself on GarageBand so that I can then send you the MP3 and so you can then piece together this beautiful multi-track crystalline podcast. And Paul, it's true, before we started I said I'm very excited, this is a new area of it. I know this is really simple technically,
it's a journey we're all taking together,
and I wanted to be comfortable, so I set up, I have a little, I'm sitting on a couch in a room here, and I've got a little footstool that I'm using as a table, and then on top of that I have a little canvas container turned upside down, and on top of that is my little microphone that I'm recording on, and I move the computer to the other side of the room so I wouldn't have these wires crossing me, and I kind of rearrange things, and as I rearrange things I forgot to plug the AC adapter back into the the laptop.
So there's the crux of the matter.
So then I'm slowly running out of power, but I'm not noticing this because I'm so engaged in our podcast. And suddenly we're in the middle of some great moment and boink, the screen goes dark. And, you know, I'm recording. I can't, it's not, it hasn't been saved. And it's, that's, this the, is so much a, thing of our times.
If you really wanted to make our demographic happy, you could say that you immediately shouted out for Brock at that point.
Yeah, Brock, come in, Brock. The screen is dark.
They're happy now. And I actually love it. Like, to me, it feels like art because there was such a wide range. We never really do, like, interview, but it seemed like we were... We had you talking about your craft, and then we were talking about your earlier experiences with music, and it was Jesus Christ Superstar that pulled the plug.
Yeah. Yes, well, we were talking about... Well, we can just start this topic up again now, because
I think
Paul
so.
And I.
Well, we should preface this by we should preface this briefly. Let me interrupt here. We're sure. our plan right now is that we are still going to post the previous podcast, which was essentially complete, except it won't have James's track on it. It will just be our reactions. It'll sort of be like, you remember those Music Minus One records when you were growing up, if you played an instrument, or alternately. Bob and Doug McKenzie did it, but it was what's his name who directed Real Life, Albert Brooks.
Well, Albert Brooks did a parody of it.
Yeah,
Comedy Minus One.
Yeah, Comedy Minus One. It'll be sort of like that. You can play the role of James Urbaniak in your own home, listening to that podcast, just filling in your own answers. We'll see how interesting it is for anyone
over the 55 minutes that it lasts.
Yeah, and James was doing a lot of talking too. I mean, I saw a lot of space in my waveform.
There'll be some real John Cage moments.
Yes. You know, so that being said, we're going to jump back in briefly on the Jesus Christ Superstar topic because I think it is worthy of discussion.
Okay. So assume that we never talked about this up to this point then. So James, I think you had introduced the Jesus Christ Superstar, and
well,
Paul was
in
right
the
on
prior
your heels.
Podcasts, we the topic had come up of what's the first LP you ever bought, what's the first cassette you ever bought, what's the first 8-track. I might not be getting these in the right order. What's the first? Yeah, what's the first CD? And what's the first thing you downloaded, I guess? Was that it? Was there another
one? Basically the first
wax cylinder. Was that
it? Technology.
Yes. The first piano roll you ever
and,
purchased.
And the first LP I ever bought was the Star Wars soundtrack in 1977 when I was 13 years old. And Paul, was it... How did Jesus Christ Superstar come up?
I don't remember.
It just came up under LPs.
I think so. Yeah. I think we were talking about double LPs and experiencing the show or the movie through the extra materials and such.
I think it was cassettes, and it was the cover art that was the gateway into the Jesus Christ Superstar.
Well, I was just saying that there are a couple of different Jesus Christ Superstar records, and I love that this whole conversation is about, we keep putting it in the past tense, which I think we should continue to do.
Yes.
So as I said in the Lost podcast, there's the movie soundtrack, and then there is the original, what Paul termed the concept album, which was a sort of dark brownish cover with like a yellow logo. Where Murray Head essays the role of Judas.
Yes.
I don't even know who plays Jesus.
It was Ian Gilliam. It was the lead singer for Deep Purple.
Oh, really?
Yep.
How I kind of lost you there. It was lead singer for who?
For Deep Purple.
Oh, right. Yeah, I did. I remember that. I wash my hands. Well, that was your demolition.
That's Pontius Pilate.
Oh, that's
actually
Pilate. Yeah,
technically speaking, that's Pontius Pilate singing that part.
But the point we were making is that anyone who knows that particular album, when they sing the songs, you don't just sing the songs. You have to sing the performances that those performers did on that record,
which, as was mentioned, are thoroughly histrionic.
I believe the term I used, yes, and I used the term off the hook.
Yes.
In the Lost podcast, which I will still use in the new podcast. And you know, Woody Allen made a whole movie, and then he reshot the movie. He wasn't happy with it, and he recast it and reshot it. Now, we haven't recast, and we might want to think about that.
That's true.
We might want to think about that, but we are re-recording, and now surely this has happened to you as recording artists, where you've lost something that you've recorded, or you're not as stupid as I am, and don't forget, you remember to plug in your Mac.
No, actually, when we had Bill Corbett, Riff Tracks, Bill Corbett on, yes. I forgot to hit play, and it was a good 15 minutes.
Or to hit record, you mean?
Yes, I did not hit record, which is essentially the same thing. That yeah. There was some technical deficiency.
Okay,
that
so there
caused...
is a precedent.
There
absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely. Wait,
this is not our first case of podcastical ineptitude.
And it's funny, because I know that you folks listening out there have no knowledge of what we talked about before, yet I feel funny about going over the same ground
yeah.
that we did, even though...
You shouldn't. Yeah. I've told these stories, frankly, I've discussed these things in other places, so I'm happy to discuss them again.
What did we talk about?
Tell us again about your obsession with fursuits.
With fursuits, yes. Well, they're you know, it gets cool in Santa Monica in the evening. So that's all, you know, if that's a fetish, so be it. I'm a okay. fetishist.
We accept that.
Yeah.
Well, let's go over the trawl our minds for the greatest hits of the Lost podcast.
I was actually going to go to an entirely different thing. Because in the Lost podcast, over the course of the hour, we never actually got to the point of discussing your work on Venture Brothers, which I'm sure is most germane to most of our fans' interest.
It's the crown jewel in my career, crown. And that's a lot of alliteration.
That was, but anxious anchorman placed in powerful positions. Sorry,
yes.
I can't help but quote broadcast news whenever anything remotely approaching a broadcast news quote comes up. It's physically unable.
I actually did a little prep before doing. We did this podcast.
Now this is not precedented. Either of us doing any prep?
No, never.
Okay,
ever.
Wait. I think we just crossed a line. We are now fully in this podcast.
I believe
we are here.
Yes.
We are a new virgin territory.
And as Shakespeare said, what's past is prologue. Am I right, people? And that's more alliteration, because he knew the power of consonants were the same.
So my prologue is from a previous interview you talked about, and in the Lost podcast, you had said...
Because you're never really completely out of the Lost podcast.
Because prologue is also past. That was the line that was in between the lines.
And prologue is precedent.
But you had mentioned that, you know, it's certainly great to get work as a character actor playing, I think you had it as the guy who gives the technical information to Bruce Willis.
Yeah, that's something I said in an interview, yes, a while back, yes.
I'm going somewhere.
The guy who comes in and reads the report of the computer in the movie.
And that it would be great to be the guy who gets the report read to.
That's right.
And when I read that, I thought, you know what? Dr. Venture is that guy.
That's right. That's true. He has the things read to him. Except he's never happy when they come in and read it.
Right.
Well, he's never happy, period.
Yeah.
But do you feel like, even though you do not appear on film yourself, that it's given you an opportunity to sort of step into that leading guy role?
Well, it's funny. The other day I auditioned for a... No, I didn't audition. Good Lord. This is hilarious. I shot a day. I just remembered that I played a dad in something, and it took me a second to remember, oh, it was actually a day I did it on a film, not something I auditioned for recently, where I played somebody's father, a little girl's father. And one thing I've always been amused by is I never go out for dad roles, even though I am a dad. I mean, I'm a relatively young dad. I have twins who are 4, But that's one of the more amusing things, is that he is a dad. And I sort of get a kick out of that more than him being, say, an authority figure or in his own way, you know. Mm-hmm. I enjoy that aspect. And yeah, he's the lead, you know, he's one of the lead characters. And now and then you have to remind yourself, oh, wow, I am this lead character in this TV show.
For any of our listeners who have not seen The Venture Brothers, I'll try to give sort of a 20-30 second summary, unless you care to, James.
Oh, you'll do it better than me. I can never remember what happens on that show.
Basically, the show, it started out, I think I can say, as sort of a lampoon of Johnny Quest combined with Scooby-Doo, sort of the super scientists and super villains, 60s look and feel type of cartoon. But it rapidly evolved or devolved, shall we say, the relationships between pretty much every character. First of all, they expanded the universe. It seems like practically every episode they're expanding the universe and fleshing out another minor character and giving him a very rich backstory and major character flaws and interesting relationships with those around them, though they're working for, whether it's, say, a henchman for one of the super scientists or, you know, a soldier for one of the many different branches of armed forces that take place in this universe. But it's this incredibly rich, sort of massively dysfunctional group of people interacting with one another under the pretense of being arch rival nemesis, I should say,
with a strict code underlying it all.
Yeah. James plays the role of Dr. Rusty Venture, who was earlier in his lifetime, prior to the time period of the show, was very much a Johnny Quest type. He was the son of a super scientist, and he was the subject That's of right. a television show. And now he's sort of, you know, the grown up child actor, so to speak, a failed See. Super scientist and
former boy adventurer.
There you go. And has two children and a bodyguard and several different nemeses. And it's a rich and wonderful and hilarious and incredibly intricate show I am fascinated to hear your tales of being on the inside of it. I will lead with one fact that here in the fourth season, somebody pointed this out. I think it was television reviewer on the Onion AV Club. Was talking about how at this point this show doesn't even bother to try and bring in people who haven't been watching for the first three seasons. Like if you had never seen a Venture Brothers episode and sat down to one of the season four episodes, any of them, even the first episode of the season, there's just no way you're going to remotely follow what is going along. You'll catch some funny jokes, but to try and suss out the relationships at this point is nigh impossible. It's like sort of going halfway into a Dickens novel.
It'd be like being a 5-year-old at the dinner table with the grown-ups and laughing at the jokes that they're telling. You have no idea.
Yeah, but there are ways to catch up,
this is true.
I mean, it's hard for me to catch up. I've said this before, but it's a funny experience working on it because, you know, I'll get this script and I'll read it, usually just a couple days before I go in to record it. And then I'll go in, and when you record, you just record by yourself. You don't record with the other actors. And you do multiple takes of your lines and scenes. And like Jackson Public, the creator of the show, will be, you know, outside of the booth kind of feeding you your lines and sort of imitating the other characters and things. And so you record the whole thing very incrementally. You don't have a sense of the whole episode while you're recording, and Jackson directs it very meticulously in his way. And then close to a year goes by, and then it airs. And by the time it airs, I really don't remember what I read a year ago and then recorded incrementally. And it's like a new show for me. And I swear, this season, I didn't go back. And sometimes I go back and look at the old scripts to kind of remind myself where we're at, but I didn't. So each episode in this second half of season four that's airing now is like a new episode for me in a way. I don't remember saying these things. There are some things I remember, but so even for an insider, it's at least for me, It's a lot to take.
So you do go back and watch the show. Do you generally watch your own performances and things you've been in, or go out of your way not to, or?
Oh, I always, yeah. I mean, I always watch performances because it's very educational to watch yourself. And the unpleasant part is when you see yourself in something or and you're not happy with it. But that's a good way to learn to improve. And you know, you screw up in a play, and well, that happened, and some people saw it, but it's not there forever. But you screw up on film,
right?
And it's always there. But most of my screw ups are more obscure. My higher profile stuff, I'm pretty happy with. Yeah, because you know, film acting is still a sort of mystery and a challenge to me in a way, you know, that's very different than acting on the stage, which I did for many, many years in New York.
Do you still have opportunities to do stage acting? Is that something that you would continue to do?
I'd love to do another play in New York. That would be really fun. Now, the last one I did was like 5 years ago. I did a play called Tom Paine by a friend of mine named Will Eno, which ended up becoming a very successful off-Broadway show. Is a one-man play where I played this character and who just talks to the audience for an hour. And Will has a new play going on, which I'm hoping to see. But I moved to L.A. 3 years ago, and you don't really move to L.A. to do theater. you move there to do TV and film and whatnot. And
unless you're really stupid.
Opportunities have come up. I've been asked, offers have come up to do plays. And like the first year I was here, I got a couple of offers to do plays in New York and also in Chicago. And I didn't do them just because I felt like I was trying to carve out, you know, a little momentum and reputation here. Mm-hmm. And didn't just want to move here and suddenly go and away for a few months.
But now
that I've been here for like 3 years, I kind of feel like, no, I would seriously consider going to do a play somewhere for a while. That would be nice.
Now, had you moved out to L.A. just because you had started getting roles and felt like you wanted to be there? Or was it just, it's James Urbaniak's time to shine in L.A.? I'm going to go out there. And
well,
just...
part of me kind of feels like I'm an American actor. I should spend time in Los Angeles. That seems the right thing to do. The initial incentive was my wife became pregnant with twins. And we realized we were going to need to get a bigger apartment eventually. We had a cozy apartment in Manhattan, and so we were thinking about the outer boroughs and stuff. And then one day I thought, maybe we should just move to Los Angeles. And very close friends of ours had moved to L.A. the year before, and they encouraged us to go out. And I knew a lot of ex-New Yorkers who were there. And meanwhile, I was still making a living, but things were slowing down in New York, and I thought, this might be interesting. So we packed up the old jalopy and went. And I've gotten a lot out of it. I do miss New York very much. And I like the way New York is laid out more than the way L.A. is laid out.
Yeah.
I do enjoy, you know, the subway. It's the best way to get around. It's much faster than a car. And I've gotten a lot out of here just from meeting a bunch of new people here who have become... many of whom have become very great friends and who are also creating stuff. And that's been really, really good.
Not to say that you don't seem like someone who should be in L.A., but I'm always surprised that you don't live in New York, if that might sound funny. But it's like when we go to New York, I think, oh, you know, we should see if James Urbaniak is around. And then Paul has to remind me, no, he lives in L.A. So.
I still kind of feel like that. I still feel somewhat displaced.
Yeah. Well, you're back often enough that it sort of seems like you're kind of still living there, or at least maintaining two apartments or something.
Yeah. I mean, I have places to stay there, but I don't have a permanent place there anymore. But I'll be driving down the street frequently looking at the palm trees and going, well, I live here, huh? This is weird. So this is where I live now. Okay, this is very strange. But there are many pleasures to be had. And again, it's like the people I've met here who I've become close to are as, you know, creative and talented as anybody I knew in New York. And there's a lot of really wonderful people here. And there is interesting stuff going on. It's just that the city is all spread out. You know, it's like there's stuff here. It's not a wasteland. It's just really spread out and you have to drive to it. And so that just has a different feel and a different energy from walking out of your apartment in New York and running into somebody and you just see some place and you walk in there. What's this? In LA, it's a little more hermetic. You get in your car, you go from point A to point B. You experience, you know, a lot of the city from inside a car.
Right.
And you're not interacting with people in the same way. Just getting around like you do in New York. And I do miss that, you know, that sort of pedestrian happenstance that New York has. Although, so great.
granted, Paul and I haven't, you know, obviously we do not live in LA and have not been there so much. But when we do, it almost seems like it's built into how people function that you get invited to stuff more. Like it's more kind of accepted that people make plans, you know, because there isn't that on the street opportunity and that there are a lot of casual opportunities to get together. And it's kind of normal to do that.
Well, there's a guy I met in LA who's lived here for a long time who said to me, he likes it because you have to work a little harder. And he said, New York is like, LA's a little more hard to get. New York is like the girl who's a little too easy. I don't agree with him. I'm just telling you what he said.
The world needs Bettys and Veronicas.
There you go.
I'm going to ask you an...
York is a slut, and I resent him suggesting that. Thank you. I just want to go on the record there.
I'm going to ask you an actorly question.
Oh, please.
That was an actorly response.
It was.
Yeah.
I can hear you waving around your handkerchief.
By the way, I'm just staring at my Mac, looking, going, yes, everything's in order.
Still recording.
It's recording. I can see the little recording. What do you call that? The little sound wave type thing.
The waveform moving along, yeah.
Just call it the blipper.
I can see it's plugged in. I can see your voices bouncing on the little Skype indicator. It's like everything's working. Okay.
Technology.
All right, go ahead. Yes, your question.
Yes, my actually question. You were talking before about how when recording for Venture Brothers, Jackson Public directs pretty meticulously, might have been the word
yes,
you used. I can't remember.
It was indeed. I've used that word many times, yes.
Do you prefer that type of directing method, or do you prefer a more hands-off method? The reason I mentioned that is I was going back over your IMDb listing, and I realized that you have worked with a reasonably enviable career, having worked with a number of really good directors. In particular, yeah. I remember that you were in Sweet and Lowdown, Woody Allen,
worked with Woody Allen, yeah.
Famous for his sort of aloof, shall we say, directing style.
Yeah, you read these interviews with people, and they always say, if he doesn't say anything, it's good. If he talks to you, then you worry, you know. And I mean, my role is, I'm in the film a lot, but it's really a peripheral character. I play a member of Sean Penn's band. And the guys in the band, one guy in the band is like his buddy and speaks a lot, but most of us are just kind of in the background. And we just kind of come in and set up. And then, you know, there's a scene where we have a gig and you see us play and then we leave. And, you know, my lines are things like, see you at the restaurant. Then
so
there's a scene at the restaurant where we focus on Sean Penn and I'm in the background doing something.
But did you find that to be the case that he was? Go ahead.
That he was what?
That he was he was generally pretty hands off or didn't give much in the way of guidance unless he didn't like it.
He was very engaged in these scenes where, say, we were just coming on stage and setting up our instruments. And I remember at one point, it was a simple opening kind of sequence where you see us getting on a stage and, you know, and he was like, okay, so James, you come out, then Brian, you come out next, and Dennis, you come out next, and so-and-so, you come out next. And then he's watching it and he wanted it like one right after the other, and like one guy was like a beat late, and Woody Allen made this gesture where he kind of lunged with his entire body forward for a moment, just like, because that was that beat. It was like, bup, 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 bup! You know, and he kind of went, bup, where's the guy? And it was only like a tiny thing, and it was even ostensibly a not a significant moment in the film. But you're watching this going, oh, wow, he's really rhythmically connected to just these kind of, the rhythm of these bodies entering the frame. And that was very important to him, that it was like, bup, 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 bup. And when it was like, bup, 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 you could see him like react to that missing bup. And he had a kind of quiet intensity like that. He was actually kind of intense, not in a kind of clenched way, just in a very focused way. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting to see how this little, like I say, ostensible non-moment was so important to him. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot doing that, just being on that set. I worked through the whole shoot. I worked on the film for like 2.5 months, and I was there at least a couple times a week. But he's not like a real, you know, you meet some of these famous people and you walk in to meet them and they go, hey, James Urbaniak, it's so great. Oh, I love Henry Fool. You know, they like, they know who you are, and they're very, you know, they just act very friendly. And it's not that he wasn't friendly. It's just that he didn't have that. He doesn't seem to feel the need to do that thing.
Uh-huh.
Right, let's have some warm energy between us. It was more technical and detached in a pleasant way. And he'd make jokes on the set, but it's like, he's not like, you know, palling around with you on the
set. So there's a job to do, and you know, you're here to do that job. And I had a vision,
a friend
in my head.
who rapped, and he was a great actor in New York named Dennis O'Hare, who played the clarinetist in the band. And he told me that when he wrapped the film, he went up to Woody Allen to say thank you, and Woody Allen looked at him for a moment like, "What? What's going on? Why is this guy thanking me? I'm confused." It's like, you know, he's just not like, he's not a hugger. Big surprise. Big surprise.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just his thing. But it was very interesting to be a part of that, and also to watch Sean Penn kind of constructing a performance on a set. Uh-huh. That was really interesting. And I kind of felt like I was a paid intern on that. Uh-huh. I was just there to kind of observe and help out a little bit and learn some stuff. And I did. But what I learned was just sort of like about managing your energy on a set. And
oh, yeah.
Because film is so radically different than theater in the way it's structured.
Now, I've heard a friend of ours has talked about it before, and you know, we've never been filmed ourselves, but I guess there are a sequence of shots taken from various angles, and that is it that you're saving your energy for that shot where it's really going to be focused on you?
You just have different energies for different shots. So like traditionally they'll have the, you know, the wide shot where you see everybody in the frame, which, you know, they call the master, and then they'll start to come in closer, and then sometimes, you know, you'll get a close up or whatever, and theoretically people save it, quote unquote, mm-hmm. for the close up, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. you kind of, the whole sequence of doing these different shots helps you build the performance, and you learn, you know, there are certain technical things that might be good in one shot and might be better in another, but you know, you start learning these little tricks.
did you get anything in particular off of watching Al Pacino work in You Don't Know Jack?
Yeah, that was really interesting. I have this part in that where I play a journalist named Jack Lessenberry, and I continue to tell people that I'm the title character in the film, but it's about
I was forgetting, in the Lost podcast we explained what that film was, but
yes, and I made that same joke in the Lost podcast, which is true. I do tell people that. That's a biopic about Jack Kevorkian, the suicide doctor guy, and that was fascinating to watch Pacino. perform. And he was very good humored. I was kind of taking my cues from him, especially when I was in scenes with him. I thought, well, if he shoots the shit, I'll shoot the shit. If he's in the zone, bother him. But he would joke around, and there was a moment where he was doing a scene, and he went up, as we say in the business. He forgot his line. Uh-huh. And we finished the scene, and he went, I went up. And Barry Levinson was directing. Thank you. And he came over and said, oh, it's okay. We had good stuff in there earlier. And Pacino was still sort of explaining himself. Pacino is a kind of apologizing to Barry Levinson. Like, this is the most common thing in the world. People forget lines. You know, yeah, no, I'm sorry. I was thinking about this thing. And the. And then I chimed in and said, are you nervous working with me? You know, which got a big laugh from Pacino. And then he like grabbed my hand like, yeah. Good one. And it's like, it's funny. It's like any little thing that Pacino does takes on an epic quality.
So right.
Like, yeah. Whoa, I made Pacino laugh. This is awesome. But yeah, it was really interesting because he would. One of the most interesting things was there were these courtroom scenes where he would go off the script and they wanted him to. In fact, we all kind of went off to degrees. But a lot of Pacino's courtroom stuff was, he followed the text, but he would add things and take things away. And that was really interesting to see how he approached these monologues where it was just him, you know, appealing to the judge, and how he would change his energy. And it's really just very classically inspiring, just because he would just like try stuff and like start a scene with a certain energy. And then in the next take, he'd have a totally different energy. And then I remember he had one take that seemed really good and it ended. And then after cut, he said, close, but no cigar. And then at one point, there was just a goofy moment where we were shooting some stuff outside of the courthouse. And it was just a scene where he's entering the courthouse and there's a bunch of extras and it's supposed to be at the height of the trial. So it's all these extras going, Dr. Kevorkian, Dr. Kevorkian, and, you know, people playing reporters and stuff. And I'm following along. And then a few of us get into the courthouse, but the camera's outside. So once we're inside, we're not on film anymore. Mm-hmm. And we've done this a couple of times, and it's just a physical exercise. It's like there's really no acting here. It's just like he just crosses the street and goes in the courthouse, you know, with all those people screaming. Yeah. And so he crosses the street, and I follow him into the courthouse, and all the people are screaming. And then there was a table inside the building where we ended up, and he then got on the table on his back and looked at the ceiling and said, I smell an Oscar. Which was hilarious. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. Al Pacino's won an Oscar. Can you make the I smell an Oscar joke if you're actually someone who wins Oscars? Like, does that joke really work?
It's a little more gauche is all.
Or meta. It's a fine line.
It is a fine line between meta and gauche.
Yes.
Storm, you still
I never
with
met
us?
A gauche I didn't like, by the way. I'll just point that out.
Oh. Storm, are you here?
I am
okay.
Here.
Sorry, I heard. Okay.
I thought your Mac ran out of power there for a second. I got nervous.
No, I
always
can't
make sure
imagine
it's plugged
doing
in.
Something like that.
You young people, remember to plug in your Mac before you record a podcast. Thank you.
That's lesson number one of the evening, I think.
Especially if you were just eating dinner and had it out there in the kitchen, and so the power was running out, and you didn't have enough power. Yeah, thank you.
I have a question from the Twitter. That when we mentioned that you were going to be our guest and we solicit topic suggestions from people.
Yes.
A number of folks whom we know.
Oh, but can I just say something?
Yes,
I like
please
that
do.
I like that you called it the Twitter, because I only call it the Twitter.
Oh, it needs a definite article.
Yeah, I always put that in there. All right,
I usually actually pluralize it. I usually call it the Twitters.
Yeah.
Joe Randazzo and Mike Kupperman have told us to ask you about your jam business. Is this some bit of randomness, or is there an actual story behind all of this? Do you have any idea what we're talking about?
Not at first. This must be some inside joke that I've forgotten.
Okay. I think we've just been Twitter punked.
Yes,
I think that's what happened there.
I think they were building off of each other's little jokes. Why don't you just give us 2 minutes about your fictional jam company?
Well, it's called Jam Urbaniak, and on the label, the ES in James is crossed out.
Mm-hmm. Clever.
Yes.
And
is there a particular flavor that you specialize in?
And there's a picture of me on the label looking like Newman, you know, Paul Newman, except I look mm-hmm. like someone just took a picture of me and I'm upset. What? You know, I have that kind of expression. Yeah, what do you do?
Did you dabble in jellies first and decide that jams was the only real pure business to take part in? Or was it just, has it always been jams?
Well, if you've ever seen the product, you'll know that on the back there's a label that says, I don't know the difference between jelly and jam. And neither should you.
Now, when you're preparing to make a jam, do you tend to observe the original source? Do you start with the process?
Here's all I know. No, I have people who process it for me. They bring it to me. I taste it. And then, if I like it, I affect a hip-hop gesture, and then I say out of the side
sort of
my mouth,
this jam is real.
I say, this jam is real.
Oh, so that's right. That motto is also on the back of the label. That's what's in the quotes. I see that's a quote from you. I thought that was just sort of a random endorsement.
No, it's the Urbaniak kosher.
That's right. And his little picture of me flashing a kind of a gang sign, for lack of a better word, saying, this jam is real.
You know what? We have to produce this. This is too good of an idea.
Jam Urbaniak.
You know what? Newman, that's old. This is the new hotness.
That's absolutely right. Okay, so we've covered that bit. So Joe Randazzo and Mike Kupperman and Ken Plume can suck it. What else? We were discussing some fictional battles in the Lost podcast.
Yeah, I think this was right around when it cut out after I had confessed.
Fictional battles.
Yes, where we occasionally will take two characters or objects or places and pit them against each other in some sort of arena that changes.
Whoa. We didn't get to this in the Lost podcast. This is a totally new podcast.
I don't remember this topic.
That's after my computer died.
Yes, you were strangely silent during much of it, but yet we managed to talk for a good 6 or 7 minutes, I think, before realizing you weren't there.
I thought I had offended you because Jesus Christ Superstar was not part of my formative experience. That's what I thought happened.
That's right. You and I had said you were missing out.
He's the heathen.
But enough of heathens. It's about battles now. So, okay, the first battle...
So what is this? This is like if Bill Bixby fought Herb Edelman?
Like that.
Yeah.
Right. Or if you want to finish that, we can have that battle.
Yeah, with the guy who played Herb Tarlick watching.
That's more sort of a one-act play than a battle, I think.
Well, unless the battle had something to do with... like if it were badminton, you know, who would win? Herb Tarlick or the Hulk? Badminton, yes.
Herb Tarlick would win that. The Hulk wouldn't be light enough on with his wrist.
And probably the understanding of rules might be a bit better on Herb Tarlick's part. Yeah. And his willingness to cheat, I'm guessing.
Frank Bonner, by the way, gentleman who played.
That's right.
I didn't even look that up. That came right out of the old poll.
Yeah, there you go.
So hit us with another one there, Storm.
Sure. Yogi Bear versus Winnie the Pooh. And the battle is who would make it from New York City to L.A. first?
Well, that's a tough one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's no easy answer to that.
Yeah.
Because both of those bears get distracted by things.
Yes.
They do, for different reasons.
For different reasons. Yogi Bear, his distractions are a little craftier. Mm-hmm. I guess Winnie the mm-hmm. Poohs are a little more just
His are more basic, you know, generally involving hunger.
Well, Yogi's are basic because Yogi just wants to eat, but he plans it more methodically.
Yeah, he's more schemey, more Phil Silversy.
Right, and Winnie the Pooh is just kind of pure id.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to crawl in this tree and get this honey. Get stuck in here.
So he's more directionless, but less likely to trip himself up.
I suppose so, yes.
Now, are we starting them out with, like, a cash supply? Or are they starting with, say, just the money in their pockets and their wiles to get them from New York to L.A.? Or do they have an itinerary?
Where would Winnie the Pooh put money?
In his honey pot. In his empty honey jar.
Who would take honey sticky money?
Amtrak actually will take any rider they can get these days.
Point taken. They each have $100.
Okay. Yeah, then yes. I would have to give the advantage to the extent that either one would actually make it. I'd have to give the advantage to Yogi because he's a little craftier and a little better at scheming his way into getting things that he wants or needs.
But like Winnie the Pooh has luck on his side.
Correct.
Storm made that same exact point in the Lost podcast. Yes.
And I swear to God, I didn't hear it because you never know when his childlike tendency toward distraction will get the better of him. But that will dovetail with chance.
Yes.
So when he grabs those balloons from the balloon seller, he'll then float up in the air. Mm-hmm. And quickly pass over the Midwest.
I would say this. I would say Winnie the Pooh would never actually make it to Los Angeles, but he would discover in the end that what he was looking for was right there in front of him the whole time.
No. See, I think he'll make it.
A Joseph Campbell book that he had on his own.
Yes, exactly. Or his keys.
No, he'll make it, but he won't know why, and he won't care that he did.
That's deep.
Yes, he is guileless. He is without guile.
I think
so. Can he truly exist in Los Angeles?
That's the good. He'll get there and he'll have no skills with which to cope with the town and turn around and go right back.
Except for being adorable, and that goes a long way.
That's true. Maybe that's how Macaulay Culkin got his start. Maybe he's just the human poo.
He does like honey.
As it were.
Pooh with an H. Nothing against Macaulay Culkin, ladies and gentlemen.
I think we've settled this battle.
Yeah. Let's do one more. This was fun.
Sure. This one is tailored for the occasion. It is Rusty Venture.
Ah, yes.
Versus Phantom Limb.
Oh, my. Another one of my characters.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The battleground is karaoke.
Wow.
And what I think what that means is it's karaoke, and who would win the crowd of the people that are there at karaoke with them?
Right. Now, I mean, my instinct is that Dr. Venture would have to win that.
Yeah, his drive to be the guy.
Yeah.
But don't you think, though, when it comes down to it, that Phantom Limb is more of a showman?
Yes, but Dr. Venture has an anger which, in terms of his onstage energy, could land as more rock and roll.
Good point. So I guess it's a question of whether or not we're doing ballads versus up-tempo numbers.
I think Dr. Venture would... Well, I think Dr. Venture would, I think the crowd would like him, but not necessarily know where he was coming from.
They'd like him in spite of him?
Yeah, in spite of him, they'd like him, exactly.
But
I think Phantom Limb would try to do a more classically, you know, presented performance, and would probably have a little more, he's got that fruity Englishy voice, he would just have a more natural technique.
Sure, and the pyrotechnics. You know? certainly.
One night in Bangkok makes a hard man humble.
That's his problem. Is he will only
even
do
though
show
Murray
tunes.
Head kind of sounds like Dr. Venture on that record, a point that has been made to me more than once.
Has it now? That's yeah. very interesting. Wow.
Bangkok, Oriental City. He kind of sounds like Dr. Venture.
Very much.
In fact, Jackson Public has talked about me recording that, you know, because now and then there are these Venture novelty records that mostly Christmas records, but it's actually been for a few years he's talked about me recording One Night in Bangkok.
Oh, I would be very interested in hearing that.
I think I speak for pretty
much kicks above the waistline, sunshine.
Yeah, I think the world needs that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think it has to do with, yes, Phantom Limb would probably have more technique, mm-hmm. just in terms of selling a song, mm-hmm. but Dr. Venture would have, in a weird way, more honesty. He'd be more raw.
Yeah,
I think you're
and
right.
I think
I'm agreeing.
An audience would respond to that than a sort of fully formed, very technical presentation, you know. Yeah. Then something real, man. Dr. Venture would be real.
I think, you know, to bring this all around, I think I'm going to lobby Doc and Jackson that you guys need to re-record Jesus Christ Superstar using That's characters right. from Venture Brothers.
No, wait. We need a more, what is it?
Need a more permanent solution to our
problem. It's going to be Phantom Limb.
Yes, absolutely. Caiaphas is Phantom Limb.
Well, that song in particular would work very well. And then Dr. Venture could be like the rock screamer in that one. What then to do about Jesus of Nazareth?
How do we deal with the Carpenter King?
Exactly. Storm's just twiddling his thumbs.
Yeah, just please, before you do it, book me a month in an educational chamber so
Where
I can get up
Where do we start with
speed.
A man who is bigger?
Then John was when John did his baptism thing.
All of them. It works really well.
I'm telling you.
Well, I said
you,
in the earlier
it's
podcast,
a mark,
which
it's
will
an
no longer be mentioned, that Jesus Christ Superstar, those voices on that, it's like an episode of the Venture Brothers. But they take themselves really seriously, which
yes,
is part of what's so
do.
Great about it.
That's the beauty of it. Well, it really kind of was it was all voice acting because they weren't doing a live show. This predates any live performance of the show. This was the original concept album. They were just recording it.
Oh. I didn't remember that it was just done as a record and then
it was
made
it was
show.
Done that way first and then they did the stage production and then they made the movie.
That record is nuts.
Yep.
I had that on cassette. I had a cassette of that.
Or two cassettes, I guess, technically.
It might have been. Although back in the day, they had these extra long cassettes. I remember buying home recording.
I remember those.
Like 120-minute cassettes, which were always very exciting.
Right. And they hyped up the various precious metals that composed the
That's right.
these cassettes. So the cadmium tape or whatever.
That's
it
right.
Is.
It'd have like a little silver rectangle on it or something.
The gadolinium tape.
Less hiss.
No, I'm remembering now also when they transitioned from albums to the cassettes, that I guess because the racks were a certain size, that the cassettes came in these big bulky cardboard containers.
Yep.
So that they would have a presence in there.
Yep.
Now, if you were taping something off of a blank cassette, how did you advance your leader track? Did you listen to it? Or did you do the pencil in the hole?
Oh, right. Wow.
Remember that?
Pencil in the hole, sure.
I would listen to it myself.
Yeah,
I would play it out.
Well, yeah, I was of the hit record method, then rewind, and then as soon as the room tone hit, I would shut it off.
Ah.
Which was a good way to do it, because it was a more subtle sonic shift between the leader tape and the blank. Unrecorded tape. You could hear it, but it was easier for me to record. And then occasionally I would get a little fancy and put a pencil into the hole and advance it manually.
Yeah, I was just never that precise in those days. I would just give myself a little extra time and figure, you know, if Come Sail Away gets cut off at the end because I wasted a little leader time, so be it. It's just sticks.
Speaking of hiss, I'm gonna finish up at least my end of things with a geeking out question. I'm wondering if either I am wrong or your IMDb listing is wrong. That you took part in the sadly only one episode ever of Snake and Bacon.
Yes.
And oh, yeah. Did you play the part? I had been under the impression you played the part of Snake.
I am in fact the role of Bacon.
Okay, then I was mistaken because your listing says Bacon.
Yes, and Peter Serafinowicz is the snake.
Is he?
He does the hissing. Yes. That's his hiss.
Wow.
I'm Bacon, and that we had done. I have an old friend who you may know, Bob Sikoriak, eminent cartoonist. He's a friend of people that you know, I assure you. But he's an old friend of mine, and he does these evenings in New York called Carousel, where he has cartoonists show their work on slide shows, mm-hmm. The carousel on a slide projector. And it's not animation, it's just like panel cartoons and different things that are projected.
Right.
And the cartoonists will either talk about the work, or if there's word balloons, they'll read the words. And I used to do these for Bob all the time, and I would do different voices for his characters.
Mm-hmm.
And Kupperman would do them, and I would do voices for Kupperman's characters.
Snake and Bacon are characters created by Mike Kupperman, by the way.
Yeah,
those of you
and they're a team who kind of do things. They're just kind of famous. It's a strip of bacon and a snake. And the snake hisses, and the bacon says things about bacon.
Yeah.
And when we first did this sort of live version of it, where we were projecting the comic strips, and I was reading the voice of Bacon, for some reason, I just thought it'd be funny to do this vaguely Dean Martin, Bing Crosby-ish voice.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying bacon facts. He's like, crumble me in a salad. <It's> like, wrap your dog's pill in me, which was one of my favorites.
Yeah.
This kind of smooth, kind of vaguely mid-20th century thing, mm-hmm. whatever it was. Well, then a few years go by, and Kupperman's making a pilot for Adult Swim, and he says, I want you to do Bacon. And I'd forgotten what I'd done in these live shows. And I thought, okay, how would a Bacon talk? And I suddenly had this image of like Maury Amsterdam, like some sort of sibilance, you know? My wife pickles because bacon sizzles. And so it would be like the sizzling thing, you know? Crumble me in a salad. And then I said, I kind of was thinking like a Maury Amsterdam. He said, oh no, I like when you did that Bing Crosby thing. And then I went, oh yeah, I forgot about that. So that's what we did on the pilot, which is a cult pilot now, because sadly nothing ever happened with that, although Kupperman has lots of stuff up his sleeve, so I'm sure there'll be more TV.
Well, it's terrific. We live in a technological age when we can have cult pilots, you know, that they're still there to be enjoyed.
But I'm glad that you didn't know I was Bacon, because that means it didn't sound exactly like Dr. Venture, which often on the Venture Brothers I do these. Sometimes, I haven't done it much in the last year or so, but we all do these sort of pickup characters, like Cop on Corner.
Right.
And consistently, Jackson would always say, yeah, it sounds too much like Dr. Venture. Stop, what do you think you're doing? Well, you can't say that. It doesn't sound that much like him. Come on.
Well, I did identify you by voice as Mrs. Storm and I were watching TV one night.
Yes.
I was perusing the internet, I believe, and she was flipping channels, and it was, I believe, one of the CSI programs.
Oh, yes.
And I remember hearing the voice, but I was concentrating on something else. And my wife turns to me and says, this guy is really creepy. And I look up, and you were speaking at the time, and it all just clicked. And I
don't believe I've ever met Mrs. Storm. So that
you have not. Next time you're in the D.C. area.
But there you go.
You can come by.
I think you mentioned that to me previously, I think.
I think you tweeted it.
Or something. Yeah,
I did
that.
Tweet it. I tell it to everyone I meet because it's so fantastic. Right. Just that little moment from
and you
the
said,
voice.
Yes, yes, he is. I've met him, and he is creepy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now, next time you're in DC, you can come by and creep her out. Next time, me.
Yeah, I was in Richmond. I didn't think of it to do any creepy crawling. Well, didn't do any creepy crawling.
She was a little creeped out a little while ago, and I think we know now why.
Yeah, just thought it was just random.
Within the creeping radius, Richmond is.
That's right.
Well, we have managed to exhaust almost exactly an hour. Another hour, I should say.
That just went by.
It did. It was fun.
That was the quickest do-over in history.
So please do, folks, if you enjoyed this, which we know you did, listen to the Lost Podcast, or rather listen to 2/3 of the Lost Podcast, because the other part is, of course, Lost.
The avant-garde supplement. That's right. These long pauses in it.
That's right.
We will know who is truly hip.
It's the podcast by Ibsen.
Yeah. Huh. Or Beckett or Pinter on Quaaludes.
I'm sorry. Pinter is actually, I guess, what I was thinking.
But thank you, James Urbaniak, for
guest
gabber.
Yeah, it was great to have you. Do you have any projects coming up you care to mention /plug/anything?
There's a handful of independent films that are either in post production or kind of making the festival circuit. There's a great one called Drones that I made in L.A. There's one called Beware the Gonzo. There's another one called Hello Lonesome, and I just shot a movie called Sound of My Voice. I don't think, did we mention in the second podcast that HBO thing about the Loud family? I don't think we got to that.
No, we didn't.
I'm very excited to be playing the role of Mr. Dick Cavett in a forthcoming HBO film called Cinema Verite, which is about the a documentary miniseries called An American Family, which was on PBS in the early 70s. This is a drama about the making of that film. And I do play Mr. Dick Cavett, which is in a way a role of a lifetime for me. I'm really pleased about that. And I did go on about that in the Lost podcast, so you can listen to that and just imagine what I was saying.
Listen to the spaces.
Which was fascinating. We'll tell you that it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
no.
We'll do that in the sequel.
There we go.
Okay. Good. Done and done. Do we have business we need to take care
of? We have a little bit of business. Very briefly, we have a few more Wootstocks coming up. But before that, even on Saturday, October 23rd, we have a show in Boulder, Colorado, along with Adam Savage and special guest Phil Plate. That's just it's not a Wootstock. It's just sort of us and Adam and Phil. That's in Boulder, as I said. Then we have Wootstocks on October 27th in Los Angeles at Largo. Then on the 29th in New York at the Best Buy Theater right down in Times Square. On the 31st, Halloween itself, we're at the Wilbur Theater in Boston. And then on the 2nd of November, we're in Austin at the Paramount Theater. And on the 3rd, we are at the Granada in Dallas, a whole slew of Wootstocks.
Go to pollenstorm.com to learn who the awesome folks we have on those shows are. They'll be appearing bit by bit. Also to find out how to become part of the Brigade of Minions, a big block dandy. That's something you want to do. And unless I hear otherwise, I'm Storm.
And I'm Paul.
And we've been talking about some stuff for 5 to 10 minutes.
On average.
I don't know how to love him. Go do things.